Well, Radio Catskill is local and independent. Neighbors keeping neighbors informed.
Right. And the more neighbors like me pitch in, folks who aren't able to support it will be able to enjoy it too.
That's right. It needs to be free for everyone.
So it's worth subscribing.
It's not a subscription. Listen when you want. Give what you can when you can.
I'll give now and help end the fund drive.
Great. Just go to WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. Or donate on the Radio Catskill app.
On this week's On the Media, a small town whodunit filled with divorce, corruption, and backstabbing. The mystery? Who is behind the brazen attack on a local newspaper?
Okay, I understand you're not people who are involved in this. Albert, you are in big, deep right.
That's okay.
You understand.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg. Last year, I bought a book at the Montpelier, Vermont Public Library book sale titled Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood by Terry Messier. What? I had to buy it. It was only a dollar. Since moving to the Catskills, I've had the great good fortune to watch hummingbirds up close, feeding on flowers and bird feeders on my deck. So when I finished this book that detailed the author's trajectory from casual bird enthusiast to devotee of these fragile creatures, I thought, wow, who does this? To answer my own question, a face appeared on my memory screen. It was the smiling face of Rebecca Kreshkoff, a true Catskill character. I hope you're intrigued. So here's my conversation with Rebecca Kreshkoff. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining me today on Catskill Character.
My pleasure, Donna.
Mine too. You know, we should tell the audience, we have a very cool connection that I found out about when you and my husband were both participating in the Yarn Slingers memoir series back in, I guess it was 2015?
2014.
2014 it started, yeah. At CASS, Catskill Arts Society.
Uh-huh. So I was reading a story, a chapter about, walking through Daddy Grace's yard on my way to school each morning. And your ears perked right up when you heard Daddy Grace's house, because this is a fairly well-known mansion in Montclair, New Jersey.
That house was something else. And you used to cut through there.
That's right.
To go to the Hillside School, where I actually taught for a year, but not when you were there.
We missed each other.
We did. I'm sorry.
Me too.
So you had been writing for quite some time at that point, correct?
Well, I've really been writing my whole life. I made my career in the corporate world as a writer. Just everywhere I landed, my writing skills were observed and put to good use, whatever my actual title was. So I've had a lot of experience focusing on clarity, which is very important to me.
In the memoir, as I recall, you had quite a few chapters that were devoted to your birding.
This is correct. Yes, birds are an important part of my life.
How did you first get into birding?
Well, it was by sound, really. I would hear a song and get curious about it. I wanted to know who made that song. So I remember sunbathing on the roof of my boyfriend's apartment on West 75th Street and hearing this long, elaborate, warbling song and wanting to know who made it. And I got out my field guide, Peterson's, of course, and flipped through it, and I guess I'd seen a little something of it. And at first I thought it was something exotic like a white-winged crossbill or a red crossbill, but I finally had to settle on the house finch.
Not so exotic.
Not so exotic, but still a marvelous singer.
Mm-hmm. Do we have those up here?
We actually have the version that is native to this region, the purple finch, whose song is a bit different, but very similar. The house finch is actually from the Southwest, and they were imported as cage birds in the 1940s to the East Coast. And they got wind one day that the feds were going to come and bust them. So they released all these birds. They opened the crates at JFK. And so from that small seed population, house finches have really taken off and grown. And so their population, the eastern population, has now met with the western population.
Wow.
Yeah, all since the 40s.
So from that perch up on the rooftop of your boyfriend's apartment building, you went into Central Park and started looking for birds.
That is correct.
And you met a lot of people who were also looking for birds.
That came a bit later. While I was still with Jesse, that's when I saw my first red-winged blackbird.
Yes, your first identified bird. That must have been exciting.
It was very thrilling because I'd heard that sound for years when visiting my sister in Maryland, but I didn't know who made the sound. And of course, everyone has heard of the red-winged blackbird. So when I tracked down the sound and saw that it was coming from this black bird with red epaulets, bright red epaulets, I concluded, aha, this is a red-winged blackbird. That's who's been singing this song for all these years. And everybody puts words to songs if they can. It helps them remember. Well, to me, the red-winged blackbird is singing puberty.
I'm going to remember that.
See, it's memorable.
So how did you go from identifying birds and becoming a birder to helping to save birds? How did that transition happen?
Well, I really have to thank Sarah Elliott, who was the grande dame of Central Park birding. I took a birding class with her in October of 1991, and she introduced me to the world of birding. I just identified a few birds on my own by that point, but I learned a lot more. Then she wrote an article in the New York City Audubon Society newsletter called The Urban Audubon about the danger of lights to birds, spelling out that a lot of birds, including most of our songbirds, migrate at night and are disoriented by the lights of our tall buildings, especially on rainy nights or overcast nights when there's no moon. Some years later, I became aware of a group in Toronto that was actually going out and looking for these birds. And I decided to follow in their footsteps. And so I started getting up at 5 in the morning, biking downtown, because I worked downtown, all the way downtown at 55 Water Street at that point. And I would walk around the buildings of the World Trade Center and the World Financial Center looking for birds that had crashed into windows. And I found them. I found a lot. That first year working alone, 1997, I found something like 431 birds. That number sticks in my head.
Oh.
Maybe it was 413, but it was definitely a lot. And over half of them were dead.
What did you do with them?
Well, I took them to Battery Park, the new part of Battery Park, not the old part, and I put them under trees. And that's where I took a lot of the injured ones, too, and I'm afraid a lot of them didn't make it because I later met the gardener there, and she learned what I did, and she said, oh, I wondered about all the dead birds under these certain trees.
My God.
Yeah, it's very sad. There was just really very limited habitat in which to put them. New York City didn't at that point have any wildlife rehabilitators in Manhattan, and I had to go to work. You know, there's a lot of limitations to this kind of volunteer effort.
So you were just letting nature take its course, in other words. You put the birds under the tree. And
yikes. Yeah, I figured at least they are dying in a natural environment instead of this really harsh, bizarre environment of concrete and steel and glass.
Yeah. That must have been so discouraging for you, though.
It was. It was awful. And I remember in the early days lying awake in bed at night just feeling terrible about all these birds because, of course, I was finding only a fraction of them. And all the birds across all the cities in America, because migration happens all across the continent, that were meeting similar fates. It's really got to be a huge drain on the population.
So you did something about it, though.
I did.
Tell us.
Well, I started by writing about what I'd found in the New York City Audubon Society newsletter, the Urban Audubon, and people started volunteering. So other people started going out and looking for birds too, which was great, and people identified more sites to monitor, and New York City Audubon has fully adopted that project, and it continues today, you know, here now, what, 22 years later, which is pretty great. And they've expanded it. They're doing a lot of science. They're researching the data they've collected, analyzing those numbers, and also doing field work, trying to identify types of glass that can mitigate the problem. What surfaces can birds identify so that they won't fly into them that are still attractive to human beings? Because let's face it, people do want to be able to see out their windows.
So is that the Safe Flight Bird Protection Group that you founded and people started volunteering?
Yes, Project Safe Flight is the effort where people today continue to circle buildings looking for birds that have crashed into windows.
And tell us about the Bird Safe Glass Working Group.
That's the group that's doing field studies. They create runs, in effect, where birds are presented with these different types of glass that have been treated in various ways or manufactured in various ways to incorporate patterns, UV patterns, what have you, to try to see which ones birds will avoid.
You know what really surprised me? I always thought that the birds ran into the buildings up high. It never occurred to me that this was a problem with light, which, of course, you disabuse me of that idea of them crashing into these tall...
Right, right. Well, it's a complex problem. Initially, they are drawn to the light, once again, especially on overcast nights or moonless nights in bad weather, because... We don't know exactly why, because, but they are. And once they become stuck, you know, trapped in a lit area, they circle around it and are reluctant to leave. And this phenomenon is well documented during the Tribute in Light every fall in the city. When I first heard of that, they actually organized the first one in just 6 months after 9/11.
The Tribute at the World Trade Center, yeah.
Right.
The site.
So the first one was held in March of 2002, and I monitored that. And then in the subsequent years, there were some nights where it wasn't so bad, but there were some nights when it was just terrible. You know, there are lots of spectators, tourists, what have you, who go to the event and look up to see the lights, and they see all these things. It looks like confetti. They don't know. They think, oh, how beautiful. Isn't this wonderful? It's the spirits of the dead people. People were saying stuff like this at the time. But no, it was birds that were just circling around and around. Because September 11th, this is peak fall migration. A lot of birds are flying then.
We're talking about thousands and thousands of birds.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And New York City Audubon has now worked out an arrangement whereby when significant numbers of birds are trapped in the lights, they ask that the lights be turned off for about 20 minutes. And the organizers of the event are now fully cooperating with this and in partnership, and they willingly do it. Because they don't want to see birds dying either.
There's enough death there.
Good point. Good point. But that was an uphill battle. I remember it was not ever thus. At the very beginning of this, they didn't quite see things our way.
Didn't they put up netting at some point?
Yes. Around the base of the World Trade Center, we actually met with the real estate people there, and they spent time and money and resources on putting up netting, you know, like we put up to keep deer off, but out, suspended out from the glass so that birds would hit the netting rather than the glass and trampoline off it. Because although the birds are initially attracted to the light, they go down to ground level. They settle in whatever trees there are, street trees, planters, you know, large planting areas around the base of tree buildings. And from there, that's when they tend to hit the glass. So just the first four stories, because they'll be perched in a tree, they'll see the reflection of the tree in the glass and try to fly to it.
Oh,
maybe there's more bugs over there. They don't know it's a reflection. Or they'll see plants inside the lobby of the building and try to get to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite pathetic and awful. You know, they're innocence in this bizarre foreign man-made landscape we've created, and they don't know.
Well, let's talk about something a little more cheerful.
Let's. Good idea.
So, in order to be out in nature, you take it a step further than most of us do. What do you do in the late spring when it gets warm enough?
I put up a tent and I move a cot into it and I make it very comfortable and I sleep out there all summer long.
And you're looking for birds and or listening for the birds' songs.
I certainly am. They wake me up bright and early every morning. Especially in June, that's peak time for singing.
Have you ever seen something really exciting while you were out there, besides just listening for the birds?
Well, unfortunately, I don't see all that much, because while I've got windows, you know, when the sun comes up, I get out.
Yeah.
If it's dark, I'm asleep.
Your observation skills are reduced to just listening.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
You actually talk the talk and walk the walk. You don't meet a lot of people like that, Rebecca, and I'm really honored to know you. I definitely have the impression that there's just no halfway with you.
Oh, you have no idea how guilty I feel about all the things I'm not doing.
Oh, Rebecca, as a therapist, I would have to work on that with you. Let's take a quick break here, and when we return, I'd like to change the focus from the songs of the birds to the singing of you. How's that?
You got it.
Okay, great. This is Catskill Character on WJFF. I'm Donna Fellenberg with my guest, Rebecca Kreshkoff, writer, birder, and more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
From everyone at Radio Catskill, we wish you a happy and safe Independence Day weekend.
When you can, take a moment to celebrate some of your core American freedoms, like free speech
and freedom of the press. Celebrate these freedoms and many more by donating to Radio Catskill during our summer fund drive.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill is taking over the pool at the Blue Fox Motel in Narrowsburg on July 12th at 1 and throwing a party just for you. It's Radio Catskill's Summer Fun Drive Pool Party with live DJ Jason Tugaw, a cash bar, and a big pool perfect for cooling down. Join us at the Summer Fun Drive Pool Party, July 12th, 1 to 5 at the Blue Fox Motel. $20 suggested donation at the door.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and my guest today is Rebecca Kreshkoff. In the first half of the show, Rebecca spoke about birds, how she became interested in them, and how that interest burgeoned into full-out devotion, carrying Rebecca from her New York City apartment at 5 o'clock in the morning to the World Trade Center to count dead and dying birds that had flown into the lower windows. She also told us that she enjoys sleeping outside in a tent in the warmer weather so that she can be closer to nature. In the second half of the show, Rebecca is not going to talk about the beautiful singing of the birds. Rather, we'll be discussing her singing and the various venues in the Catskills that provide a place to perform. Let's get back to it. Rebecca, have you been singing since you were a child?
Well, I suppose everybody sings. It was early in my young adulthood, I sang in the Grace Church Choral Society for a couple of years, and that was wonderful.
That was in the city, right?
In the city, yeah, Broadway and 13th Street. Lovely little church, and doing lovely works like Brahms' Requiem. Thank goodness it was in English. But then I stopped for some reason and didn't pick it up again. And over the years, you know, I tried playing violin for a while, and my sister, who is an instrumentalist, would just say, well, why don't you go back to singing? Because, you know, I'd say, oh, I want to play the clarinet or what have you. So she just kept on planting and replanting that seed. And when I came up here, I heard about the Sullivan County Community Chorus. I didn't join right away, but in December of 2015, I sang carols with Dickens on the Delaware in Calicoon. And I've been singing with them ever since. very wonderful and excellent music director there, Kevin Giroux.
Were you aware when you first moved up here that there were so many opportunities for singers?
Well, first we rented, so I was reading the River Reporter, so I'd actually heard of the Sullivan County Community Chorus and seen some productions of the Delaware Valley Opera.
And since that time, who have you been singing with and what roles?
Well, as an alto with the Sullivan County Community Chorus, and I've sung a few times with the Delaware Valley Opera. A couple of years ago in Carmen, I was a cigarette girl. That means the chorus, women's chorus. And then last year, there was a production of Trial by Jury. I was one of the ladies in the audience there. That is to say, on the stage in the audience.
And weren't you also a reporter? Or was that
Yes. That's what I meant. I'm sorry. I was not in the audience. I was playing the role. We all sat in the same box, audience, and it's a small stage, the Tustin Theater. And then I was the third spirit in The Magic Flute. That was really thrilling. Mozart is so gorgeous.
And haven't you done a lot of work with Tanis Kowalczyk?
Yes. Courage, 2017. Yes.
That was a huge production.
That was. Cast of, 25, if not thousands. That was thrilling. So, yes, I was part of the women's chorus for that. And we performed at Apple Pond Farm and on Governor's Island in New York City.
What was that like?
In truth, the farm was more fun. Better setting. There's a lot of distractions on Governor's Island.
Oh.
A lot of people, a lot of tourists visiting, and a lot of helicopters flying low overhead.
Oh, that doesn't work.
We tried to incorporate them. We would shake our fists at the helicopters because this was the oppressive military, we pretended. But we had more flexibility at the farm.
How has your voice changed over the years? Have you noticed any changes?
Well, I've certainly noticed it improving and my range expanding since I've been taking voice lessons. I always considered myself a solid alto, I mean, really low, and I like the low parts. But it turns out that my upper range was waiting to be developed, and I'm working on that now.
Wow, that's so exciting.
It's very thrilling, yeah.
And tell us who your teacher is.
My teacher is Matt Rupsich, who is the music director for Delaware Valley Opera at this point, among other things, many other things. And he really knows his stuff. He's a superb teacher. I'm learning so much from him. But I also have to acknowledge Carol Diefenbach, who was my first teacher up here. And I learned a lot from her, too. She put me in a very good place.
Do you have to do anything to keep your voice in shape?
I vocalize every day. I try to do the exercises. My homework that I get from Matt, I try to do that daily, and I'm always working on music either for the Sullivan County Community Chorus or repertoire that I'm working on with Matt or material for a Tanis production. Right now we're working on madrigals for the upcoming Shakespeare on the Farm to be produced this summer.
Tell the audience what a madrigal is.
A madrigal is a song from, let's say, Elizabethan times. There was a very intense period of flowering of the English madrigal, late 1500s, early 1600s. And the madrigal, it's all a cappella, so no background, no supporting instruments, anywhere from 3 to 6 voices, different voice parts. And one thing that's interesting about it and different from the way we approach music today is that there isn't a melody that's supported by harmony. All the lines are equally important. So it's the fusion, it's polyphony is what it's called. Every line is important. It's not like the sopranos get the melody and everybody else is harmonizing along with them.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it very interesting and really beautiful.
Now that's with the new company that Tanis just formed.
That's correct.
The Farm Arts Collective. Yeah. Very exciting.
It is.
I heard the words Carnegie Hall somewhere. Tell us about that.
Ah, yes. Our group, the Sullivan County Community Chorus, has been invited to sing at Carnegie Hall. Now, don't get too excited. We've been invited to be a supporting group for another chorus that has hired Carnegie Hall. They are not quite big enough to fill the space properly, so they need a supporting chorus to come and fill out their sound. We've been invited to join them, and Kevin is being very strict about this. He doesn't want to rain on their parade because they're paying lots of money for this privilege. And so we will audition, each of us will audition to be part of the group that goes to Carnegie Hall. But we've been rehearsing and practicing and learning the music. That audition is coming up in a couple of weeks, so I will find out if I will be going to Carnegie Hall and singing there on Tuesday, May 28th, when a bunch of other choruses will be singing too. But we are singing a really gorgeous piece of music by Dan Forrest. It's called Requiem for the Living, and it is amazing.
So if you get in, that will that be your Carnegie Hall debut?
It most certainly will.
Well, I hope you do. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed.
Thank you, Donna.
So if I were to pass your tent in the morning, might I hear you singing accompanied by your chirping friends?
Well, that's interesting. Last summer, I did lie there in bed in the morning and did breathing exercises, but I was not singing. But that might be a good idea because that way I wouldn't bother Lenny.
I don't think Lenny's bothered that much, do you? Lenny is her husband, by the way, I should mention.
He is wonderfully supportive, and if I ever get too loud or too high, he just puts on his headphones and watches a movie.
That's the way it's done.
Yeah.
Rebecca, thank you so much for coming in today. I really enjoyed it. You have such great information about the birds. It was like an education for me, and I really appreciate it, and I wish you good luck with all your singing endeavors, and keeping my fingers crossed for Carnegie Hall.
Thank you so much, Donna. You're so sweet.
You have been listening to Catskill Character on WJFF Radio Catskill. My guest today has been Rebecca Kreshkoff, and I think she qualifies for the moniker Environmental Activist. She's also on the advisory council of the New York City Audubon Society. That's nycaudubon.org. Catskill Character is on WJFF every Saturday morning at 10:30, right after Cats Cast. Please tune in to 90.5, 94.5, or stream online at wjffradio.org for more fascinating stories of people with what I like to call Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. I hope you're having a great holiday weekend. The Declaration of Independence, which rejected the tyranny of a king, justified the start of a new nation, and asserted key fundamental rights, was adopted 250 years ago, 1776, on the 4th day of July. And later that evening, John Hancock ordered copies of the document from printer John Dunlap, who hastily made about 200, and then word spread. So even when independence was declared, no one knew about it till the press worked through the night. The famous spirit of 76, that was a revolutionary excitement of a people choosing to self-govern, full of high ideals, courage, and civic duty, and that spirit came as much from printers like John Dunlap as it did from the wealthy landowners in the Continental Congress or the poor enlisted men on the battlefield. That spirit came from thousands of couriers, public speakers, and pamphleteers whose names we don't even know today. A diverse, decentralized media network carrying a detailed and robust conversation that ultimately changed the world. You can't have liberty without information. You need discussion, debate, and education to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, and you can't have a union of free people if the people are being kept in the dark. And that's the spirit that lives on here at Radio Catskill. Not just Independence Day, but every day. It's been 1 year since Congress rescinded our public funding, but we are still here, free and independent, keeping folks informed, keeping democracy healthy. Thanks to listeners like you who stand up for what's right. Please, stand with us today. Make your donation now at wjffradio.org. Thank you so much.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.